by way of introduction for Shirley Hoekstra, there's the bio that we left some extra bios in the tables. It's on the website that you looked at for the BOT conference. She is a gifted and accomplished leader and leading an organization, the CCCU, that is not only a challenging organization to lead, but also a highly impactful organization to lead on behalf of Christian colleges. And so beyond what you can read there, I'm going to say this. Somebody asked me once about the convening of our day-long Wesleyan Education Council with, you know, presidents and board chairs. And they said, man, that must be like herding cats. And I said, it's like herding lions. And so Shirley Hoekstra herds 120-plus some lions all the time as a full-time career. So that alone should make her fully qualified to say whatever she wants to this room, and we hope she will. So Shirley.
I love all those lions. So good to be with you. Thank you for the invitation, Wayne and Gus and Joanna. I'm very happy to be here. It's already been a providential set of hours for me. I didn't know what God would have in mind, but as I said to Russ and Joanna, when the Wesleyans call, you say yes. And I'm honored to be here with you because I so value Christian education as expressed through the Wesleyan heritage. And also, when you say yes to something, God has more in mind than you can predict, right? You think that you're going to do a presentation at lunchtime and a breakout room, and then instead, or in addition to, God gives you conversations that he wanted you to have that you didn't know were lined up for you. So I'm so grateful that God does that. So actually, every time you say yes, it's like a Christmas present. What's going to be inside the package? So I hope to give you a gift a little bit today with the next 30 minutes, and then we have a breakout session that will actually dive a little deeper into the content of this presentation. And I have to say, everything I learned about how to be the leader was when I was a junior high school teacher. I think that was my hardest job. It was 7th and 8th grade. I taught English. I tried to teach them pronouns and prepositions and all those things. I loved teaching them because they were before cool. At least when I was teaching, junior high was a little before cool, and they could really love you, and I loved them back. I then went on to take my law degree, and then I went back as a volunteer, as a board member at Calvin University. And while I was on that board, the vice president for student life had gotten a call to be head of another nonprofit, and there was an opening. I was much younger then, a little bit more brash, and I said, hey, I think a woman should apply for that job. And I went on my merry way, having dropped that little wisdom there. I get back to New Haven, Connecticut, and I hear God very distinctly nudge me and say, what about you? I was like, oh no, I have a plan here in New Haven, Lord. I don't have to wash my car for Sunday. My drapes don't have to work right. I don't think I want to move back to Grand Rapids, Michigan. That's not my plan. And it was very, very clear that I was supposed to be obedient and send in an application. Now, I did say to God, you know, if this is just obedience, if you say no, that's okay, because that would be a win-win. But they came back with a job offer. And I thought, really? You want me to relocate, change my whole profession? I'm unqualified. I'm not a higher ed professional. I'm unqualified. And he said, I've got a good staff for you. And he said, there's this thing called the CCCU, and they will help you get the professional development you need. And I said yes. I was there for 15 years. And interestingly, it was the CCCU that gave me all my professional development so that I could actually do the job that God had called. Now, just think, 9 years ago, I've had this law practice, and I was a litigator, high conflict things. That fits my job now. And then I was in higher ed, so I saw a lot of the issues that all of your campuses deal with. And I had an opportunity to apply for that role in Washington, D.C., and God saw fit to take the training that I had, first as a junior high school teacher, then as a lawyer, then as a higher ed professional, and say, would you help advance Christian higher education. And so why do we worry, right, when God has a plan set out for us? And that's what, that has been so true in my own life, and I know in your lives as well. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Christian higher education in the 21st century and about board responses. I love this from Phil Ryken, president of Wheaton College, because it says here, the enduring mission of Christ-centered higher education is what? To educate whole persons, to build the church, right? And to build society worldwide. We are best linked when we are closely linked with the church and Christian higher education. But this is what the issues feel like, right? This is what it feels like. And not only that, this is what it feels like. little tired, especially after the pandemic, that's what it feels like. And sometimes it's just like, maybe it will just go away, but unlikely not. And so this is what we do. We solve problems by sticking closely together, the church and the colleges. We have each other's backs. One of the things that I had experience as a lawyer, working in a secular place, obviously, and as a Christian, I was so grateful for my Christian higher education experience myself, because I had the opportunity to share my faith in ways that I had not done in a Christian bubble. And I had grown up pretty much in a Christian bubble, and I move out to New Haven, Connecticut. It's a very secular place, and I'm in a very secular law practice, and people would ask me about my faith, and ask me why I prayed, ask me why I would go to church. And I was ill-equipped, by the way. I grew up Reformed. We're not so good with the whole evangelism thing, you know, because of the theology. We don't have to go any more into that. But I did get associated with the Evangelical Free Church. Now, they're really good at it. And I learned how to share my faith as an adult through the Evangelical Free Church. And that's the thing that I am so passionate about today, is the opportunity to be in the places that we serve and that we get to actually share our faith. Because in the end, the ball game, of course, is eternal life. And in the meantime, we have all this opportunity to serve. So what guides my life in high conflict places where I know I'm going to be meeting non-Christians? That's a lot part of my life. Of course, we work together as Christian colleges and universities, but the CCCU's job is to be a bridge-building organization, so we get to have lots of conversations with lots of different people. Before I started, I sat down and I said to myself, I need to chart out what are going to be what I call my guiding verses, and you see them here. And I have used these the last 9 years, and this idea of love God with your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. This is a bit more of what Albert Tate talked about us. And then go therefore and make disciples. We can do all of this, but if we do not grow discipleship in the people that we meet and the work we do, we haven't hit the nail on the head. But this is the posture verse. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And every now and then I'll be criticized for hanging out with the wrong people. And I say, oh, well, I'm the wrong people. And Christ said, hang out with me. And so I actually think it's a real advantage for me to be with individuals just like myself who are sinners. And I've also always found that it's kindness that leads to repentance. And of course, you cannot have a love for God with your heart, soul, mind, and strength if you haven't had a sense of needing to repent. God is kind with me, and I want to be that kind of kindness to others, because maybe it would allow them to take a second look at why they might need a Savior. And then always be prepared to give the hope that you have. I get a lot of questions. I was one time in front of a whole group of, a whole group of gay donors. And I was invited there to say why I thought Christian higher education and LGBT issues didn't have to be at odds. I'm telling you, it was like me and one other person seemed to be like the only people in the room. And I thought, what an opportunity. And the first thing I said is, well, let me tell you why I'm involved with Christian education. And I got to give my testimony. And I says, this is why I love Jesus. This is why I think Christianity is so important. This is why I think Christian higher education is important. And I thought this was a mission field opportunity for me. And then, of course, do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. We do this in our advocacy work and other places. But then to whom much is given, much is expected. We have international institutions that for about $10 million are educating about 50,000 students. The scale is so much different, and that's because they know that to whom much is given, much is expected, and we have so much. Even when we feel financially thin, we are so ahead of the game with all the resources that we have. Sometimes I'm in scary places. Sometimes I'm not quite sure what to do. And this verse, be strong and courageous, right? Do not be afraid, for the Lord your God goes with you wherever you go. Nothing is impossible with God. Haven't you seen it? Yes, and I have seen it, and I love that verse. And then I love the last one, because as I said, as a Calvinist, we get a little bit in our head and think we can do it all ourselves. Maybe you Wesleyans have had that every now and then. But then he says, he stayed with them to the end, glorious completing what he had begun. Our job is to be faithful, not to complete, note to self, right? And I love that verse. And so sometimes you're in situations that feel big and audacious and you're not quite sure what to do. And this is that verse that adds it all together. Christian higher education and higher education generally, here we are. This is us, right? We're a very, that's in the U.S. So there's 4,700 degree granting institutions, and we play, I think, an outsized role in helping higher education keep its mission and its purpose. We are a wonderful exemplar of it. This is a little bit about CCCU. We have 185 plus around the world, and the countries around the world are growing and wanting to do Christian higher education. And we serve Christian higher education by doing advocacy, professional development, and in telling the story of Christian higher education. We're constantly wanting to make your jobs easier, and we're constantly wanting to make sure that people understand us and are freed from misconceptions. So, as trustees, when you think about what are the distinctives of each of your institutions, there are three: Christian truth, Christian formation, and Christian witness. We at the CCCU hire a Christian higher education hires only Christian faculty. And then they integrate the faith, the Word of God, into the academic work. This is our number one distinctive. And the CCCU continually works to assist in making sure that that remains our number one distinction. Second to that, though, is the Christian formation of students. They don't get to accidentally come upon formation opportunities. It's central, both in the classroom and in out-of-the-classroom situations. But then for what? Why have all this good education? Why have all that discipleship? For what? Because we want to graduate students who advance God's redemptive purposes in the world by living out the gospel in word and action. That's why we do it. That's why we get to have these incredible students who come. That's why we get to work with colleagues who are so amazing. It's because we are advancing God's redemptive purposes. We have third-party endorsers, and David Brooks, maybe you know him as an author and columnist. He has come to faith over the last 7 years. And in a recent lecture that he gave at a BioLogos event, he said that it was actually being invited to Christian colleges that continued to feed his interest in Christianity. He would come and meet the students. He would come and meet the college presidents or whoever had invited him and the faculty. And he said, there's something different here. Isn't that just a great thing? He was a secular Jew. He had, of course, grown up in a very secular culture. And he's the one that translated what we do. A devoted heart, a courageous mind, and a purposeful soul. Isn't that what we do? That's what you all get to do when you're serving your campuses. You are helping human beings to have a devoted heart, a courageous mind, and a purposeful soul. His observation, and of course he is an observer of American culture, he would say almost no other set of institutions in American society, and actually everybody wants that. Every college student actually wants a devoted heart, a courageous mind, and a purposeful soul. But if you're not at a Christian college, it's like you're not on the right highway. You might find it because there are good Christian faculty at secular institutions, but we've got an advantage here. And that's why when you serve as trustees, remind yourself that your purpose, every time you get that really big fat board book and you wanted me to read all that, that's, we say yes, because this is what I'm hoping to make sure happens. So here's, we're going to talk about these first two. We're going to talk about some board member essentials for good governance. I've got six of them, and the other four we're going to handle in our breakout session. But when I want to go over these, this is what I think are about essentials for good governance, because board members come, number one, with an understanding of the industry in which you serve, right? So this is why in Paul, when he was talking, he said Inside Higher Education is a great free digital newspaper. The Chronicle of Higher Education is a good free digital newspaper. I put on your tables, I'm sorry, I didn't know how many tables there were, and I didn't take enough because I took my workout equipment instead of taking more magazines. I'm just going to confess it. And I only had room for six. But I want you to know it's online. The magazine is online, but I also want you to know there it is in front of you, right here, the Advance magazine. Hold it up for me. Yep, got our tall one. Hold it up. That Advance magazine is available for you online, but also to the presidents in the room, if you would like to get that hard copy for all of your board members, it comes out twice a year, we'll send you. You call my office and say, send me 30 copies by May 20, and we'll get you the spring edition, or we'll get you the fall edition. And I'm going to talk today, the bulk of my conversation with you right now for lunchtime is about the trends and challenges in higher education. And you're going to see how the Holy Spirit is knitting that conversation together with your other speakers. But the second thing I want to talk about is this posture of a board member. Is it a posture of a watchdog, or is it a posture of a guardian? And so we'll talk a little bit about that too. And they actually share some components, but it's about the posture or the attitude you bring to the fiduciary duty and the oversight that you have. And then what in the world is shared governance? If you're at all thinking about that, we can talk about that in the breakout room. Or how fast can this ship be turned? Practicing good board hygiene. And then learning from people's successes. I have a number of case studies that we can talk about. So if that interests you, join me in the breakout session. So first of all, let's talk about higher education as a sector. So this applies to whether you're Christian or secular or public or private. And the first thing is, there is, and you've heard this from Paul, there's a shrinking trust and an assault on the college degree advantage. And right here I have here, according to the Department of Labor, if you are a college graduate, your income will be $64,800. That's the median if you have some college. If you have not gone to college, this is the median, okay? And, of course, there are all other examples. Like we heard earlier today, and it's very true, you all know people who did not go to college and are spectacularly successful. That's true. And we also know people that feel like they never got to get out of some cycles of poverty or cycles of advancement because they couldn't go to college. Now, hopefully in the U.S. with community colleges and with other sorts of things, it's becoming more and more available. But there is, you are all familiar with the unfair press story, are you not? And are you also familiar with the fact that they seem to never want all of the facts that might make it a more even story, a more fair story? They really want the headline, dog bites person. That's what they want. And so the headline, it is so true that college education actually lifts up a family and lifts up generations. It's completely true. But that's not a story. That's old news. What they want to have is the story and, about the outlier or the student debt, and that's a problem. I mean, we can acknowledge that. But you're investing in a very important thing, which is your future. And the average debt for a Christian college person, the average debt is $24,000. Average debt. Now, I got a medical student's son. right? He just graduated from medical school and his debt is $250,000. It's true. And he's going to get some debt relief and he's going to work at a wage that's going to let him pay that back. Is it? And that's what he picked, right? It's going to take him a while. And he has very old cars. And we go, yeah, we did too when we were that age. But the point is that a college education and that $24,000 of median debt is actually a good investment. It's a good investment for you, and it's a good, but they don't want to tell that story. But I want you to remember that story. So we want to work on the whole affordability piece, but it's not as bad as people say. The second thing is the urgency to state the positive case for the unmistakable advantage. When you hear that, as board members, you say, you know what? While it is true that people can be very successful without a college degree, we think that there is more to a college degree that is shaping our nation, shaping our world, shaping human beings for what God might call them to be in the future that makes it worthwhile. They should at least try it. Here's what the best of a liberal arts education is. You learn to write, to speak, and I love this phrase, move through life, right? Life is complex. But if you go to college, hopefully the faculty members and the experiences that you have will help you be prepared to move through what? An unexpected set of circumstances in life that you've been able to get prepared for. This is what I think is hugely important, to be a good citizen. I recently did a poll of our schools to see how many people were teaching civics and how about democracy. This is fragile, more fragile than we thought. And we want to, I am so grateful to wake up in the morning and have safe streets. I don't have to have a razor wire around my house. My judges are not bought off. My police officers are fair and honorable. I want that. I can go to a shop at night. Things are lit. I get my things get plowed. I get my garbage picked up. This is all civil society that we take for granted. I want my city to be good. I want my county, my state, and my nation to be good. And I want to raise up good citizens. And I want them to be good humans. The goal is to create a noble life. Again, think about it. A noble life has got a real history, a storied history to it, where you serve, where you get to live safely like I've just described. But if you're a Christian, that noble life is about the fruit of the Spirit. And when you can live your life freely as a religious person, your whole life freely as a religious person, and you can contribute the kind of writing, speaking, beauty, loveliness, graciousness, this is what hopefully a liberal arts education is helping our young people to be. Number two, again, the business model that is under constant pressure. It's true, you know that, and we have to think about it as a group. I loved what Paul said about the collaboration kinds of things that could happen. So a positive way to say that is Christian or higher education, Christian higher education too, is on the cusp and needs to be embracing the new realities of different student demographics and content delivery. Instead of seeing it as a burden, it is a providential moment in time to do something that God has a plan for. A providential moment in time that God has a plan for. That's why we're in this time in history right now. Not to bemoan it, but to embrace it. We do have this whole idea of digital delivery and the Amazon factor. Any Amazon users here? Raise your hand. Yeah, I know those brown boxes just come to my door. I stopped short of ordering brass cleaner through Amazon. I thought I could go to my hardware store. We don't have to order it there, but I thought about it. But students, see, have lived in the Amazon factor world. So if your admissions process, you know, feels a little bit like 1960, which I know it doesn't, but if it did, that is going to give them a jarring kind of experience about your institution. We can't ignore the fact that everything is fast, easy, convenient, seamless. Did you ever like order something online and it didn't auto-populate and you had that like annoyance that Albert Tate talked about? You know, like, it doesn't auto-populate. What's wrong with this company? I don't even know if I should order from them. Maybe they won't even get my delivery here on time. They don't auto-populate. Okay? So think about our... So this is an opportunity for us to step it up. But also, our competition... it used to be that the reputational history of your institution made a difference. In some ways, it does for the top tier because there are some other benefits. But the vast majority of those 4,700 institutions, people see them as absolutely interchangeable. They think, oh, I could go over here to this college, I could go over there. They don't even, families today don't even know how to check out quality. Right? So one of the things that in those freshmen or, you know, the visit days, we have to teach families what to look for in terms of quality. Like if you're, for instance, California. In California, you can't graduate in 4 years if you go to a public institution because they don't have enough classes for you. Right? So you may want to take that class, but you can't take that class because that class is full or not offered. It will take you 6 years to get through college, even though you wanted to do it in four. There are certain things that we take for granted because of excellence that you need to teach your families, your parents, your congregation members about what makes a highly reputable college opportunity. And they have to stop judging it by the sort of digital age that they're in and start judging it by what's the quality of the faculty that are teaching you? What's the quality of the peers you're going to be learning with? It isn't actually about bricks and mortars. It's about the relational interaction. And then it's about the alumni. What kind of alumni are loyal to that organization so that they will help you on your journey as you step out into serving the kingdom? Those are all the sorts of things that make up reputational integrity. The other piece is that in Christian higher education, we are looking to craft the soul of our students. And again, as David Brooks said, students that whether they're attending a Yale or a Princeton or an Elon or Michigan State or Wisconsin, Ohio, wherever they're going, people long. We know there's a hole in our hearts about wanting more, wanting purpose, wanting meaning. And in Christian higher education, we have to be concerned about the digital delivery and the Amazon factor. And as board members, you must ask the question, how does this impact the soul crafting that is our distinctive? How does it impact the soul crafting that is our distinctive? So here are factors that are somewhat out of our control that affect the business model. What state you live in is going to be a big factor in your business model. So in your state, if you're in a southern state, people are moving down south. So Texas and has a big advantage. Florida has a big advantage. The other southern states are seeing a relocation resurgence. If you're in any of the Rust Belt states or in any of the northern states, you're seeing a drain of individuals. So what do you do? Actually, it's not just the 18 to 24-year-old that you have to educate. And to the point of our this knitting together of messages, the idea of certificates, the idea of the lifelong learner, the idea of the grad program that was really hit hard during the pandemic. But there is about 70 million adults that need degree completion. So as you think about the business model, think about what does your state need and then go after it. Also, we're going to have a slide about the increasing number of minority students that want a college education. Is your campus ready for a more diverse population? Do your students who are diverse feel as much of an owner as your Heritage Wesleyan student feels? What about this idea of workforce education? The question was about the industries that are looking perhaps to give even an educational benefit. You don't have to do a four-year degree. You could partner with the industries in your area to say, would you give an employee benefit for this certificate? What do your employees need? Maybe we could meet that need. Cal Baptist is one of the, just by the way, McKinsey put together some research for us. 50% in between 2010 and 2020, 50% of CCCU schools grew in enrollment, and 50% of CCCU schools lost enrollment. And when you look at who was gaining enrollment, it was all non-traditional enrollment and very, I would say, strategically placed. One institution living in a particular economic area did an absolutely intentional reach out to all of the industry and said, oh, you're in the healthcare industry, you need this kind of employee, we can help you with that. Very intentional, very data-driven. Another different denomination, that institution said, you know what, we have a lot of first-generation individuals coming into our churches. They don't want to leave their jobs and go to a campus. We will take the campus and come to that church. Now, limited offerings. We're not talking about 60 majors or minors, but we're talking about three important majors that could give them that lift that they were looking for in their congregation. One of the things we have to remember with student retention, it's influenced by family, employment, and cost. So how do you help that non-traditional student go to college when they have a family? Do you offer, I don't know, did you ever notice that sometimes on our campuses there's nobody in classes after 5:30? So much open space on our campuses at 5:30. Well, how could we fill that up? If you're working, you're not coming to a 10 o'clock class. You're not coming to a 2 o'clock class. The best you could do is maybe get to a 5:30 class. There again, that if you have, like in Indiana, there's a lot of Indiana schools that are close by. What if they got together and said, we are going to offer an evening kinds of degrees by using the campuses from the buildings and space from all of our campuses? Lastly, there are increasing costs due to regulation and accreditation. Nothing you've done wrong, no one's done wrong, but actually the U.S. government is putting costs on that we didn't have before. Number three. There is more attention on campuses due to employee management and campus climate. If you don't take care of your talent, you're going to have different kinds of costs. And so, especially post-pandemic, people are tired. They want more flexibility. There's a less habit ritual. It got disrupted. So you used to just think, oh, I'm going to drive in every day. Right? Or I'm going to do this every day. That's been completely dismantled. And so now we need to spend some time looking at this very seriously. The first two, exhaustion and flexibility. And do our employees on our campuses feel noticed, valued, and listened to? Now, that's your administration's job. But as a board in this oversight role, you can say, tell us about the state of the employees. Have we funded it to the degree that we need to fund it? Administration, do you have the tools you need to help manage the campus tensions? In addition, of course, the crown jewel of an institution is its faculty. And when that faculty feels like the bargain they made, and this was the bargain they made for most of them. I'm going to go to school. I'm going to spend a lot of money getting a PhD. I'm going to get a level of expertise that's very valuable to the students I'm going to teach. I'm going to care about them, and I'm going to actually have a particular kind of life because I love the life of the mind. I'm going to eschew some other things that I might have because I just want that job security. I want to be able to teach this craft. I want to be involved with students. And now we tell them that their job is insecure, because we have to do layoffs. We have to change up the order of things in the classroom. And this makes people afraid. So a question by board members to the administration is, what's the morale of our faculty? Do they feel afraid about their jobs? Do they feel like they're going to have no say in what happens to their lives? And it may be the answer is yes, they're not going to have any say. But what could you do as an employer to make sure that that separation or that change in their lives was done in a way that was most humane? Those are the kinds of questions that you can ask. The other one is this idea of polarization and free speech concerns. public higher education has a really tough go with free speech. They have a lot of cancellation. The data shows that Christian colleges have the most freedom of speech. And you know why? Because we're not afraid to hear the kinds of conversations that other colleges might have canceled. And then who is ready for the next level of leadership? That's a board question. Are you caring for your president? Is he or she doing well? But then who's going to come next? Who are you getting ready, not just for your own institution, but for Christian higher education as a whole? All right, we're going to spend the last 5 minutes on Christian higher education, because there's two, what I would say, are board knowledge areas. The first one is mission fidelity when there is a mid-culture that conflicts with faith values. If any of you heard Tim Schultz today, you were hearing about that. So the CCCU right now has a case called Hunter versus Department of Education. That's in the Ninth Circuit, a very unfriendly federal circuit. And 44 Christian college students, of which 21 were CCCU students, joined in what is a class action lawsuit to sue the Department of Education to get rid of the Title IX exemption. Now, the Title IX exemption is the linchpin to our freedom of mission. And if the Title IX exemption did not exist, we would not be excused from government regulations that impinged on Christian mission. So it's a very important lawsuit. The CCCU joined as an intervener because we didn't want 21 individual campuses to have to defend this in the Ninth Circuit. And as an association, we said we can present the positive case for Christian higher education. But this is just one of those things that is going to be continuous, where Christian mission is under pressure and assault. And you all, as board members, just have to make sure that your paperwork is all well and good when it comes to your Christian mission, because a case could be coming to you at any time. And your job is to ask your administration, are our documents in good shape to prove that we are, in fact, a 100% Christian mission? The next case is this yeshiva, where a gay student rights group sued Yeshiva University, and the New York court said, you're not really religious. Now, that's a big surprise for a yeshiva to say you're not really religious. Now, they had some complications. Their graduate schools were less religious, right? They had some difference between what they did with graduate students and what they did with the undergrad. But actually, New York State has ruled incorrectly, and this is going to go right up to the Supreme Court. It fits squarely into what is going on. But this is a government intrusion on Christian mission. When the courts the courts ruled that the gay student group had to start immediately. It got worked out for now, but it's a significant case. Here's where government works with Christian mission. This is James Cabal. He is the Undersecretary for the Department of Education. He is at one of our universities. It happens to be Calvin University. And we went to visit him in Washington, D.C., the CCCU did, my staff. And we said to Undersecretary Cabal, what are you interested in? And he said, I'm interested in debt forgiveness and debt management, student debt management. So we can help you with that. We'll get out your information. The second thing, I'm really interested in Second Chance Pell, which is the Pell grants that are now going to go to incarcerated individuals. And we said to him, have you ever been inside a prison? Have you ever seen one of these programs? He said, no, I actually haven't. I'm just, I just know that I want to see prison reform. I know that education actually is the best way to do prison reform. And so I want to support this, and the Department of Ed has been a leader in getting, because there was a time, and I could see why, they're like, we're not going to give money to prisoners, for goodness sakes. That's like a waste of time and money. But what they found was, if you support higher education, in our case, Christian higher education, and go into the prisons, you will change the prisons and you will change the people. It's amazing. It's resurrection, folks, when you see it. Just telling you. He came to Hamline Prison. It's just an incredible story. He saw it. He saw Christian education at its best. The students, the incarcerated students, just could not say enough about what this had done in their lives. And he came out, and in a press conference, the question was asked, why do you think it works so well? And he said, it's their mission. Isn't that great? Woo-hoo! Win for the team. Okay. Forming Christ-centered and world-ready students. This is the second big challenge and trend. Where our students are coming with less biblical knowledge. Our students are coming with less habits of faith. Not all, many. Lots of students are coming, even because they want what we have or want what our sports teams have, with no faith. Okay? I hear about all of you doing baptisms. Woohoo! More wins. Okay, but now, on our campuses, we have to be building resilient faith. Right? This may mean a reordering of how we are teaching what we're teaching. And what you all as board members have to ask your administration is, tell us, have we given enough resources to make this happen? Do we have the right structure to make this happen? Then I'm going to show you a slide in just a minute. Diversity through kingdom lens. This is a kingdom imperative. This isn't a secular imperative. This isn't CRT. This isn't wokeism. This is about, and they shall be one. This is about diversity through a kingdom lens and then strong mental and physical health. These are all challenges as we are forming students, which is that second distinctive of CCCU schools. I'm going to close with these two statements. At its best, Christian higher education shapes the human soul to pursue the moral good, to love the right things. This is what boards can ensure in your role. And I want to say this about your role as a watchdog or as a guardian. When you're a watchdog, what you want really is to have the school be excellent, right? You want excellence. That's why you feel like you've got to make sure it all goes right. A watchdog posture is this. When you're a guardian, you're doing this. What don't I know? What can I learn about how that is happening? It's the way that you pose the questions. It's the curiosity you have, and it's the generosity of your open mind to hear what's going to happen. That's the guardian of a sacred trust. One of the things that sometimes boards find out is they find out that what they thought was happening wasn't actually what's happening. And you feel a little embarrassed. Like maybe a leader comes in and says, hey, this is what the financial situation is. Or did you know that this is where we are on faculty hiring? And you go, oh, I didn't think that. And I've been a board member. I was supposed to be a guardian. Stop right there. You've obviously hired someone who is helping you see your institution through good eyes, and they are capable of moving forward with your support in this way. What do you need from us in order for you to continue to advance in the problems the administration has had? But if you find, and I found this, something can happen on a board's watch that you didn't expect. And it is a moment not to overreact, but a moment to trust the new leader. This is what resilient faith looks like. We'll go over that in the breakout group. 1 in 4 post-millennials are Hispanic. That's to the demographic. What are other people saying about us? An education that refines our sentiments, that teaches us to cherish the true and the good, is a gift beyond measure. And at their best, this is what Christian colleges and universities have to offer, and it's a lot. This is what people are seeing. You are doing good work. You are doing essential work. Every college needs board members like yourselves. I want to thank you for your service, and I'm going to conclude here, and we'll go out to our breakouts. Thank you.